Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 25 and the Russians have just surrounded the 6th Army between the Don and Volga rivers. They've shut General Paulus into the city. Already, Field Marshal Manstein is planning to use the 4th Panzer Army, the remnants of the Axis forces such as the Italians, Romanians, Hungarians and others, into a semblance of a powerful force to smash into the Russians west of Stalingrad in an attempt to free Paulus and his men. Adolf Hitler had already denied Paulus permission to try to break out, so by the 24th of November, the 6th Army commander and General Schmidt flew back to their new headquarters at Gumrak, inside the Kessel, or Cauldron, as it was known, and 8 miles to the west of Stalingrad. Paulus brought along a supply of good red wine and Veuve Clicquot champagne, a strange choice for someone supposed to be planning action. Even more symbolic, Veuve Clicquot means Widow Clicquot. While Hitler was ordering a battening down of hatches, all the German generals in Stalingrad were of the opinion that a breakout was necessary. The most outspoken was General von Seydlitz, whose headquarters were only 100 yards away from Paulus's. On the same day, Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring, back in Berlin, heard that the Führer wanted the 6th Army to stay inside Stalingrad and so summoned a meeting of his transport officers. Göring told them that 500 tons needed to be flown into Stalingrad daily, while the real figure was 700 tons. The transport officers replied that 350 tons would be the maximum, and then again, not consistently. It was more like 100, and on bad days, none. Göring then informed Hitler, with what historian Anthony Beaver calls breathtaking irresponsibility, that the Luftwaffe could maintain the 6th Army in its present position by air. It was a big lie. Goebbels, the propaganda minister, had said that big lies are always believed, and this was another. The problem is, when leaders lie constantly, the real world eventually catches up. Hitler sent another message to General Paulus where he used the phrase Fortress Stalingrad, which was the final death message for nearly 300,000 men squeezed into the Kessel. And worse, Hitler was intimating that the Volga bank must be held whatever the circumstances. Luftwaffe commander in the Stalingrad sector, General Richthofen, was beyond disgusted. He wrote in his diary that the officers had become little more than highly paid NCOs. Hitler also sensed that this was the high water moment of the Third Reich. He was trying to fight an inexorable tide, and the Volga River was the symbol along with Stalingrad. Lose both, lose the war, lose the Reich. The only general who broke with the other spineless officers in the face of the wrath of the lunatic in charge was Seydlitz. He jumped the gun and said it was completely unthinkable that an army with 22 divisions should go into all-round defence and thus deprive itself of all freedom of movement. So he ordered 60th Motorised Infantry Division and the 94th Infantry Division to burn their stores and blow up their positions, then withdraw to the north side of Stalingrad. The general burned his own equipment himself just to prove he wasn't kidding. But he also wasn't thinking straight. The Russians spotted the huge fires and smoke from miles away and guessed the reason. They set up a turkey shoot and caught the weakened divisions on the open steppe as von Seydlitz withdrew from Spartakovka, inflicting terrible casualties on the Germans. Hitler then went into a rage upon hearing about the withdrawal, thinking Paulus was directly opposing him. In a sign of just how far gone the Führer was, he made the extraordinary decision to split the command of the German army inside the Kessel. The German dictator believed von Seydlitz was actually a fanatic of resistance, so made him commander-in-chief of the northeastern part of the Kessel, including Stalingrad itself. Of course, Paulus received the message and personally walked the 100 yards to Seydlitz's headquarters and handed him the signal. "Now that you have your own command," Paulus muttered sarcastically, "you can break out." Seydlitz was deeply embarrassed, and General Manstein suggested a more equitable solution, where Paulus was still in charge. But it just goes to show how the so-called German organization and invincibility was beginning to fall apart. Hitler wanted blood, and if it wasn't the Russians, he may as well make it one of his own people. He wanted retribution against General Heim of the 48th Panzer Corps. The reason was Heim's 48th had been surrounded during the first days of Operation Uranus, and barely broke out to the west, instead of fighting to the death. So he ordered the general to be relieved of his command immediately. The Führer then mulled what final military discipline General Heim should receive. Should he be shot or demoted? sent to the front as a lowly NCO or lieutenant? Haim had become the scapegoat for the entire German officer corps. Hitler decided on dismissal and arrest. Haim ended up being placed in solitary confinement in the German town of Morbitt. But he would eventually be recalled in August 1944 and fought the Canadians at Boulogne, where he would surrender in September 1944. Back in December 1942, and outside the Kessel was General Manstein, who was really one of the few hopes the 6th Army had. Manstein despised Goering and loathed Himmler, and what was not well known is that Manstein was part Jewish. That, of course, didn't stop him having Jews rounded up as part of the Eastern Solution on Hitler's orders, however. And yet, as a joke, he trained his Dachshund called Knirps to raise his paw in salute on the command, "Hail Hitler!" On Hitler's orders, the plight of the 6th Army was being kept from the German people. It was only on the 8th of December, 3 weeks after the event, that it was acknowledged there had been an attack south of Stalingrad and a hint that Paulus may have been cut off. This fiction would last all the way through into January, with propaganda reports in Germany speaking of the troops in the area of Stalingrad. But the news was spreading back home. Soldiers of the Wehrmacht spread the reports amongst themselves. A soldier in a field hospital heard a chaplain say, "The whole 6th Army is surrounded," then spoke to his family. This had a chilling effect on German civilian morale, as they began to suspect that the truth was being kept from them. Paulus now faced the most difficult question of conscience for every soldier, whether to disobey his superior's orders in order to save the lives of his men. Many Wehrmacht officers now hated the regime and despised the Führer and referred to him as Grofas, which is an acronym in German for Greatest Commander of All Time, and they began to plot against the Führer to save their country. Isn't it amazing how grandiose world leaders refer to themselves as the greatest this or the greatest that, while the reality is they are inept, crass, historically disabled, intellectually challenged, narcissistic, and psychopathic. They become the biggest failures as the number of their own people's deaths rise about them while they indulge themselves in aiming at red herrings to obfuscate their own deficiencies. That was Hitler. Still, Paulus had a chance to make it out of the Kessel, but the time was now. But during the first week of December, Paulus told one of his generals when pressed on breaking out that it was too late. "I know that history has already pronounced judgment on me," he said forlornly. Incredibly, the Russians had no idea just how many Germans and their allies they had trapped in the Kessel around Stalingrad. The Russians guessed it was around 89,000. Incredibly, the real figure, including Hueys, who were the Russians who'd made the fateful decision to fight for the Germans, was 290,000. This included the remnants of two Romanian divisions, the Croat Regiment with the 100th Jager Division, and a motor transport column of Italians who had picked a very bad moment to come to find wood near Stalingrad just before Operation Uranus. In the fighting west of the Don and on the northern flank, Strecker's 11th Corps had suffered most. The Austrians' 44th Infantry Division had lost 2,000 men, the 376th over 1,600 and the 384th over 900. As both sides took stock in the first week of December, officers of the Wehrmacht were sitting down at makeshift tables in earth bunkers under the snow, burning candles and writing, "I have the sad duty to have to inform you that your son..." The Red Army continued to try and split the 6th Army as its commissars interrogated captured Germans to find out which units were the weakest. They found out that there were only 140 German tanks left for Paulus to use, and these were badly handicapped by a lack of fuel and ammunition. This led to orders such as the one on the 6th of December, where a battle group from the 16th Panzer Division was sent into a counter-attack against the Russians on foot. The once feared panzer crews were slogging through the snow in their badly designed boots. Second in command of this battle group was the last officer to cross the Don River during their retreat east towards Stalingrad, Lieutenant von Mucius. He was proud of being the last man across. His men were to attack a hill to the north of Babukin, which they managed to seize quite quickly. Then their problems started in earnest. Russian tanks appeared out of a nearby balka or ravine, supported by a large number of infantry. The order was given to pull back, which turned into a rout. It was every man for himself as the Germans fled on foot, running for their lives. Half of the battle group was wiped out, and Lieutenant Mucius was hit, falling into the snow, badly wounded. He shouted, "Spread out!" and waited for capture. Despite this sort of incident, the Red Army also realized after a number of attacks against the boundary of the Kessel that the besieged were far from beaten. The Russian 57th Army in the southwest of Stalingrad in particular had suffered heavy casualties, with one report suggesting that infantry and artillery did not interact very well. In other words, friendly fire. There were weak points, and one was obviously the Austrian 44th Division, against which the Don Front Russian Command continued to apply pressure, including air raids using the effective Sturmovik ground attack aircraft. While many Lanzers believed they had a good chance of rescue, the reality began to seep in that the Russian Operation Uranus may have sealed their fate. This was further underlined on the 7th of December when the 6th Army Chief Quartermaster signaled to Paulus that rations cut to between a third and half so that the army can hold out until the 18th December. The lack of fodder means that the bulk of horses will have to be slaughtered by the middle of January. The Luftwaffe pilots based at Pitomnik Airfield were also under no illusion. They knew a minimum of 300 flights a day were needed to restore the 6th Army's fighting capacity, but Goering's brag was a hapless exaggeration. The Reichsmarschall, safe and sound back in Berlin, had not the slightest idea what he was talking about, perhaps also because by now we know he had developed an opium addiction besides being slothful and obese and had succumbed to Hitler's brand of delusion. Firstly, the Red Army Aviation, as it was known, was now far stronger than the Luftwaffe in the Stalingrad theatre. Secondly, the anti-aircraft batteries surrounding the Kessel, many staffed by women, were taking a high toll on the lumbering Junkers tri-motors as they slowly made their way overhead. Thirdly, the weather. It was so cold now that the Germans couldn't start the aircraft engines, and for days on end, the fog hugged the ground, meaning no planes could take off at all. And fourthly, many German airfields were now within the range of the much-feared Soviet heavy artillery. Richthofen continued to threaten, to shout the odds, to defy Hitler and Paulus, but no other Luftwaffe general dared to suggest anything negative about Goering's crazy plan of supplying nearly 300,000 men shut inside the Kessel would be seen as treasonous, so they kept their mouths shut. Each Junker could carry around 2 tons, and the other transport, the Heinkel, was quicker but carried much less. These would land at Pitomnik Airfield, offload and upload the wounded. Then, during the first week of December, the Germans began to fly out their female nurses to keep them out of Russian hands, doing so ahead of their wounded. Hearing about this, a large group of Croat officers arrived with their Russian mistresses and demanded they also be dressed up as nurses and flown out too. A colonel in charge of Pitomnik refused. The Croats, though, managed to smuggle their woman out anyway. The situation inside the Kessel in the first week of December deteriorated rapidly. Most soldiers were now living like soldiers in the First World War, with older members, who were veterans of that conflict, using the same gallows humour. General Mud had appeared shortly before General Winter. The tricks of survival in trenches began once more, including using warm urine to wash hands in the freezing weather. Peasant villages were raided for all their wood, and the houses were reduced to shells. The peasants themselves were forced out into the Arctic conditions, doomed to freeze to death. Each German soldier tried to turn their bunker or hole into a home, even with framed postcards. The ground was frozen too hard, so many used existing buildings or burnt out tanks and hollowed out the ground beneath, burning fires to try and warm the earth and then to scratch at the soil. Dr. Kurt Rauber, the priest serving as a doctor with the 16th Panzer Division, whom I mentioned before, had somehow carved out a huge bunker into which he stuffed a piano he'd found. Then he began to play Bach, Handel, Mozart, and ironically, Beethoven's Pathetique Sonata in a kind of obsessive interpretation, which apparently was quite beautiful, but quite mad too, lurking in his bunker, hammering away at the slightly out-of-tune piano as the Russians' heavy artillery shells rained down around him, shaking the walls as the loud thuds reverberated around his hole in the ground. The average German soldier ditched their steel helmet, which turned into a kind of head freezer, and instead used Russian uniforms, including fleece-lined soft tunic jackets, which were highly prized. They killed stray dogs and skinned them to make gloves. The plagues of lice, which had always bothered the soldiers and caused much sickness, now really began to emerge in large numbers. In the front lines, latrines could not be dug, and soon the steppe was a place of frozen poison, and those who ventured out during the day were easy prey for snipers. Dysentery broke out. Soldiers would squat over shovels, then throw the matter back over their heads over the trench wall. A deadly life turned disgusting. Kurt Rauber wrote in his diary of these squalid conditions. We squat together in a hole dug out of the side of a gully in the steppe. We're surrounded by a sad landscape, monotonous and melancholic. Winter weather of varying degrees of cold, snow, heavy rain, frost, then sudden thaw. At night, you get mice running over your face. On the Russian side, things were only marginally better, despite the fact that the Red Army was better supplied. Commissars preferred to order the men to sleep in the open, despite the fact that bunkers and trenches were supposed to be dug. Frostbite began to take its toll on the Russian soldier too. The best supplied and equipped Russian soldiers now were the snipers. Operating in pairs, many women, they would crawl out in their white outfits at night. One would carry a telescope and the other a long-range rifle. Their casualty rate was far higher than in the city of Stalingrad itself, and yet because of how much better they were fed and clothed, there were more applicants for this job than Soviet planners could use. Red Army soldiers had turned the tables on the Germans. It was the Russians who now taunted the enemy with threats of drowning in the Volga or the Don. Some companies began sending out men at night carrying a scarecrow dressed up as Hitler. They would erect these in no man's land and hang a placard around its neck, inviting the Germans to shoot it. It was now that the NKVD propaganda companies hit on a brilliant plan. They would set up loudspeakers and blast out tango music for hours on end, which was judged to convey a suitably sinister sound in the whistling snow out there in the steppe. At first, the Germans laughed this off, but over the next days and weeks that would follow, the incessant sound began to have an effect. It was cumulative. It was death by the last tango in Stalingrad. It reminded the Lanzers that they were in a hopeless position, and it grated on them. The context between these two lines was particularly vicious in the southwestern corner of the Kessel. But there were also tacit agreements between reconnaissance parties. They would pass each other at night in no man's land, pretending they didn't see each other. Each had specific orders for a specific task and did not want to be waylaid in their mission. However, if they met head on, then the fighting was conducted in deadly silence with knives and bayonets. When I killed a German with a knife for the first time, a Russian recce platoon commander remembered later, I saw him in my dreams for weeks afterwards. Manstein was not sitting idly by. He was putting together a counter-offensive called Operation Winter Storm, which would be a two-pronged attack. As we'll hear next episode, the wily Russian general Zhukov had predicted exactly that. And, just for good measure, Zhukov and Stalin had a second major offensive of their own planned around the same time called Operation Little Saturn. It was going to be another supreme tussle between frostbitten men and frozen machines on the freezing Russian steppe. And a big thanks to William, as well as Owen, who've sent a message to me this week about a major biking initiative they're planning here in South Africa. My previous podcast covered the Anglo-Boer War and featured a Boer fighter called Dennis Reitz. They're planning to cycle over 2,800 kilometers, tracking Reitz's journey across southern Africa during that war. That's an amazing initiative, and all power to them. So please rate the podcast on iTunes. If you want to contact me, head off to the website abwarpodcast.com, or you can send me a note on Twitter @DesLatham. Until next, goodbye.